problemas, la verdad.
Yo lo que más destacaría del máster serían los profesores. Ellos son unos grandes profesionales, te motivan muchísimo con el inglés. Por supuesto, los materiales exclusivos que tenemos en el programa.
No estás como en una clase típica cogiendo apuntes, escribiendo, lo trabajas hablando. Y eso es muy complicado, porque coger una frase y de repente tener que hacerla en interrogativa, en negativa, cuando no lo tienes delante, ayuda a que la agilidad verbal y tu capacidad también con el idioma sea cada vez mayor, porque es un reto.
Una de las partes que más me gustó del programa fueron las presentaciones a las que me tenía que enfrentar prácticamente cada semana. Otra de las cosas que más me gustó del máster fueron los dos Found Town a los que asistí, porque esas experiencias eran siempre inolvidables y es una manera de darle un empujón importante al inglés.
Ya lo has oído, apúntate al máster de inglés profesional, ahora por videoconferencia. La misma calidad e intensidad, pero sin perder tiempo en desplazamientos. Entra en grupobaugan.com e infórmate.
Esta es la hora extra con Richard Baugan.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to a new edition of the Extra Hour. This evening, what are we going to do the evening of Monday? Monday the 14th of September. What shall we do? Give me some ideas. I've been doing radio shows, teaching English on the radio for how long? Almost 17 years, and I've run out of ideas. Se me han agotado las ideas. I've run out of ideas. I need somebody to come and give me an injection of new energy, new spontaneity, new ideas. Come on, come on. Give me some ideas. Come on, or ask me questions. I don't know. As usual, I can answer your questions. I always enjoy trying to answer questions. Do you have a question? Come on. Come on. Shoot. Shoot. Se hace mucho disparo cuando esperas una pregunta. Shoot. Ask me a question. Ask me a question. Yeah, okay. You have a question? Good. Shoot. All right. Will tailors still exist in 50 years? Oh, tailors. Sastres. My tailor is rich. Ever since I came to Spain, even today, people still say from time to time, my tailor is rich. My tailor is rich. El método Asimil, which I think was a good method, I don't know. But when I came in 1974 and started teaching, people, all the students said, my tailor is rich. Everybody knew that sentence. And even today, occasionally, every so often, once in a while, every once in a while, every now and then, from time to time, cinco formas de decir lo mismo. Occasionally, from time to time, every once in a while, every now and then, every so often, somebody says, my tailor is rich. Okay. I wonder if there's any tailor that is poor. A tailor. Now, the equivalent for women is a seamstress. Seamstress is costurera. Seamstress, because seam is escrito seam. Se pronuncia igual que parecer, seam. Seam is la costura, seams. Bursting at the seams, se me rompen las costuras. I'm bursting at the seams. A seamstress. So, but a tailor. Tailor. You say modisto y modista también. Tailor is sastre. So your question is if tailors will still exist in 50 years. Let's see, we're in the year 2020, so in 2070. Well, I'm sure, yeah. The thing is, fewer and fewer people are wearing suits. I haven't worn a suit and tie in 2 months, I think, or 3 months. I don't wear my suit and tie. I don't dress semi-formally. In English, to dress formally is fraco, smoking, o parecido. That's formal, attire. Attire, attire's atuendo. or vestimenta, attire. Semi-formal is a corbata. No, not a pajarita, not a bow tie, but normal tie. So, fewer and fewer people, I think, are wearing suits. So I would probably think that suits are sold less than 30 years ago or 40 years ago. My father had in his closet, my parents, by the time I left home when I was 18, by the time I left home, very soon my parents had walk-in closets. A walk-in closet is un armario que puedes entrar andando. You tienes a torre. It's bigger and you can dress. It's como una little. It's like a very small dressing room. And I remember my father probably had 50 suits in that walk-in closet. One time he said, "You know, the government should allow people like me to deduct the expense for suits. I've spent a lot of money in my life buying suits, trajes de vestir, a lot of, because it was part of the uniform for working in my industry, in the insurance industry." He said, if I had had a different job, I could have saved thousands of dollars in suits. But tailors, I think there will be fewer tailors, very few. Probably in 50 years there will be some very special tailors, almost designers, what you call modistos o diseñadores, probably more than tailors, designers. Because I've only bought one suit in my life from a tailor, and I was 23. Because I was working with a woman who insisted, "You need to go to a tailor." And I didn't like the suit, by the way. And so since then, all my life, I have bought suits in department stores, usually, or in specialized shops, Men's Warehouse. I buy suits in the United States. I've probably bought maybe 30 suits in my life. Nah, 25 suits in my life. And I think only two or three I've bought in Spain. Because they're so much more, they're much less expensive in the United States. Even in New York City. Of course, it depends on the parity of the euro and the dollar. But at the current parity, paridad, at the current exchange rate, tipo de cambio, la paridad, euro dólar, at the current parity, which is about, I think it's one euro is equal to $1.18 or $1.19. It's very, very cheap. And besides, clothes are less expensive in the States than in Europe. Almost everything is less expensive. Except wine. Wine, olive oil. I think oliva is more expensive in the States. But it's interesting. Sometimes wine, no, because the exporters from Spain or France or Italy or Portugal or Argentina, Chile, Australia, they want to penetrate the American market. And so a bottle of wine that you could buy in a supermarket here for 15 euros could cost 12 euros, the equivalent in the United States. And you say, wow, why? It's because they're trying to penetrate the market and using pricing as a mechanism for penetration. So whatever. But in any case, the suits are quite a bit less, maybe half the price for the same quality. And so I buy suits there. In the U.S., but I haven't. The last time I bought a suit was 3 years ago in New York City, in Manhattan, in Macy's, I think. Macy's is a very famous department store. Department store is the word we use in English for grandes almacenes, like the Corte Inglés. It was interesting. And so it's a very good department store. And on 33rd Street, 32nd Street, and Broadway is Macy's. The entrance is on Broadway on one side. On the other side, it's on 6th, 7th Avenue, I believe. It's just where Broadway cuts across 6th Avenue. Interesting. Manhattan is an interesting city. Well, excuse me, New York is an interesting city. It really is. And some people are overwhelmed by New York City. Abrumados. Say, boh, lo odio. Una jungla de cristal. But it's a fascinating city. Madrid, Barcelona also are very interesting cities. Paris, London, Rome, Berlin. Well, Berlin was so destroyed in the Second World War. But nevertheless, there's a certain flavor in Berlin. All of the major cities in Europe are very interesting cities. Vienna, Milan, the big ones. I'm not talking about smaller ones. Europe has, in fact, the most attractive cities in Europe are, for me, are the smaller ones, like San Sebastian, Santander, Valencia, Seville. These are smaller cities. Naples or Venice, you see, and in Germany, you can go to Munich or to smaller cities. Well, they're not very, some of them are not very small. For example, in the United Kingdom, Edinburgh in Scotland is a very interesting city. It's one of the most surprising. It's a very, very nice city. Istanbul in Turkey is a very interesting city, but it's a monster. It's an enormous city. The city I've liked the most, if I had to live for example, if God told me, he said, Richard, yes, God, you're going to live for 20 more years in good health. I'm going to give you that opportunity on one condition. Oh, yeah. What? You have to live in Europe for those 20 years, and you can no longer live in Madrid. You have to choose. So I said, for the next 20 years with good health, I have to live in a European city that's not Madrid. I would probably choose Valencia. I wouldn't choose Genoa or Venice, or I wouldn't choose any city outside of Spain. I've never been to Oporto, but I prefer the Mediterranean over the Atlantic. The Atlantic is a little bit too cold for me to enjoy the beach. And also the weather is less predictable. But I would do that. I would live in Valencia. I think Valencia has a good quality of life. It's not too big. You can move around. The Malvarrosa is a very nice beach. And then you can go to the south, you know, to Denia, Javia, and down in that area. And you can go to the north, up to along the Castellón, to Beni Cassim and places like that. So, but really, Valencia itself is a nice city. So, the question was, will tailors still exist in 50 years? Yes, but I think there will be fewer tailors, fewer and fewer, because people buy clothes off the shelf. Prêt-à-porter is the French word, prêt-à-porter, off the shelf. So saliendo de la shelf. Shelf is estantería, off the shelf. And so, yes, tailors will still exist, but in less quantity. More questions. Okay, Richard, let's see. Are the younger generations more selfish than their elders? Wow, that's a good one. I'm not sure our listeners understood that question. Would you mind repeating it? Could you ask the question again? Yes, are the younger generations... Usas el plural. You mean the millennials and the post-millennials? Perhaps, yeah. Okay, are the younger generations more selfish than their elders? Elders, sus mayores. So, that means my generation and my parents. Yes, well, selfish. Selfish is egoísta, egocéntrico. That may not be the right word. Spoiled. Spoiled? Oh, my God. This is an interesting debate. Spoiled. Let me find a better word. Let's see. Spoiled is a mimado consentido. Okay. That usually refers to children, not to an entire generation. Spoiled. Mimado consentido. Podrido. También. Echado a perder, estropeado. Okay. Spoiled. Let's find some synonyms for spoiled. Pampered. That's interesting. Pampered means mimados. In fact, there's the first and groundbreaking introduction of disposable diapers or nappies was called in the United States. En Estados Unidos decimos para pañales de niño, decimos diapers, escrito, pronunciado, diapers. The British say nappies. Now, the first brand of disposable diapers, perhaps in the 1960s or 1970s, were called Pampers. Yes, para mimar al niño con pañales fáciles de desechables, disposable, and plastic. And I remember at the beginning, many pediatricians tried to dissuade mothers from using them. No, no, the babies need to have normal cloth, de algodón or something, normal cloth around their skin. But the mothers didn't listen to the wise recommendations, apparently, of the pediatricians, and they started buying Pampers. So to pamper. But the question here is, are the younger generations more pampered, selfish, egoistas, self-centered? You know, there is something different, definitely. There is something different. The younger generations have grown up in a more protected environment in the Western world, in the first world, in the, what do you call it? The developed world. The last two generations have been brought up in a more protected environment. And the parents have spoiled them a little bit more. Consentido, consentir. ¿Cómo se dice? To consent, pero no es lo mismo exactamente. Consentir. In Spanish, consentir. Let's see. Oh. To allow, to spoil. Sí, ser muy indulgente, muy permisivo. To be very permissive. Yes, with the children. More than in my generation and much more than in my parents' generation. And you notice it in certain things. Just yesterday, by accident, I was surfing. I was changing channels. I was channel surfing. And I stopped for a moment with an interview in the United States with an interesting person. He was the national chairman or presidente nacional del Colegio de Árbitros de Béisbol para las ligas infantiles. Wow. Y adolescentes. What we call Little League. In American English, when we refer to baseball, it's just baseball. We have the big leagues, and then Alevines, Juveniles, Benjamines, we call them the Little Leagues. Pequeñas Ligas. The Little League. And we say Little League Baseball. El béisbol de niños y adolescentes jóvenes. Now, the umpire is the word we use for referee. Referee is el árbitro, but referee is used in football, American football, in soccer, and in basketball, in hockey, everywhere. But in baseball, we say umpire. umpire. Like in tennis, se dice juezilla. I think they say the umpire. The umpire. Umpire. It's a very strange word. I don't know the origin and the etymology of that word. Now, in this interview, the president of the National Association of Little League Umpires said that the biggest problem they have is with parents fighting with each other. Parents from that are representing kids and from different to the competing teams, and then fighting with the umpires. And this man said the biggest problem the association has is that they're losing umpires. Árbitros. Umpires refuse because they get beat up. Los papás. And these umpires, I mean, it's a baseball game for children who are 10 years old, 9 years old. And a father gets angry and goes out and starts hitting the umpire. Or the parents on one team start shouting at the parents who are supporting another team with their children on opposite teams, and they start having a fight in Las Gradas. And this is happening according to this interview. This man, he said, in these incidents have increased 500% in the past 20 years. Which means the parents are much less respectful and for the umpire in general. And I think this is a case of the millennial generation and the post-millennial, the snowflake generation. So are the younger generations more spoiled or selfish than their elders? I think so. But maybe they'll grow up. Maybe they'll grow up. They have been brought up in a more protected environment. And so it will take them more time to adapt to the demands of, you know, of supporting yourself, supporting your family, the responsibility, assuming responsibility. It's interesting, marriage, people just don't get married. The poor, you know, businesses, I can imagine businesses that are dependent on marriages everywhere. You know, a person who makes, or a clothing shop for weddings, wedding dresses and things. It must be terrible. But in any case, come on, ask me some more questions. We still have a little bit of time before the break. All right. Richard, should children hear English in their infancy? Should children hear English in their infancy? Well, if they grow up in an English-speaking country, yes. No, I mean in Spain, for example. Well, you've heard me. You've heard me recommend this for the past 15 years on the radio. Why do you ask me this question? You know my answer as well as I do. Children, if you want your children to be bilingual in Spanish and English at the age of 23, when they enter the labor market, then you need to start at the age of 4 days. That's when the child gets home from the hospital after birth. Usually the mother and the newborn baby are in the hospital for 3 days, or four maybe, depending on the complications of the birth. But when you get home, put near the crib or the cot. Los británicos dicen cot, C-O-T, near the cot. The Americans say crib, C-R-I-B. Ahora, la palabra cuna, la palabra clásica es cradle, cradle. But we don't use that word for the contemporary cradles. We say crib in the United States and cot, I think, cot in the United Kingdom, in Ireland. Cot. In American English, cot is un catre. Es un cot. Me imagino que en Gran Bretaña es las dos cosas. Catre y, y, y cuna. Ahora bien, si usamos la palabra cradle, cuna, in a figurative way, la cuna de la civilización occidental, Greece is the cradle. Greece and Rome are the cradles of Western civilization. Cradle. But in any case, the child's ear should be exposed to the sound of English 1 hour a day, or maybe more, at least 1 hour a day, and simply as noise reaching the child's ear. And I recommend that you choose one specific accent. It doesn't matter which one. It can be a London accent. It can be a Scottish accent. It can be Irish. It can be a Texas accent. It doesn't matter. Because after a person becomes accustomed to a certain accent, then that person can easily understand other accents. It's not difficult. When I was 6 years old in Houston, Texas, I was able to understand Lawrence of Arabia. And the actors speaking in British English were no problem. If I didn't understand them, I didn't understand Americans. It was because the actor was not enunciating clearly. I'll be right back after the break. Don't go away.
Nuestro curso de inglés por videoconferencia es la opción perfecta para perfeccionar tu inglés en poco tiempo y sin perder tiempo en incómodos desplazamientos. 100% online, por videoconferencia, desde cualquier lugar. Grupos de 6 personas como máximo. Horario de mañana o tarde. Prueba de nivel gratuita. ¿Qué más quieres? Nosotros no podemos darte más facilidades. Ahora te toca a ti. Entra en grupobaugan.com e infórmate sobre nuestro curso de inglés por videoconferencia. ¿Qué? ¿Ya has oído hablar de Vaughan Play? Si quieres saber qué es eso de Vaughan Play, entra ya en vauganplay.tv y descúbrelo tú mismo. Con el código Vaughan gratis tendrás una semana gratis para navegar por vauganplay.tv y descubrir lo nuevo que te ofrece Vaughan. vauganplay.tv. ¿A qué esperas? ¿Quieres aprovechar el tiempo en esta nueva normalidad y resolver tu viejo problema con el inglés? Apúntate al Máster en Inglés Profesional, ahora en modalidad de videoconferencia. Los mismos profesores, la misma calidad, la misma intensidad, pero ahora desde tu casa. Infórmate en grupobaugan.com. Máster en Inglés Profesional de Vaughan.
Sí, dígame.
Ahora tu profesor Vaughan desde tu casa, la oficina. Tu profesor Vaughan en clases telefónicas. Ahora más fácil y cómodo. Consigue uno de los 3 planes de formación en grupobaugan.com/clases telefónicas.
Si lo que quieres es resolver el inglés y no solo dar clases año tras año, llama a Vaughan. Somos los únicos que te diremos la verdad, te marcaremos el camino.
¿Quieres tener un profesor Vaughan? ¿Quieres tener toda la intensidad de una clase Vaughan desde casa? Te lo ponemos muy fácil. Clases Vaughan a través de videoconferencia. Una de las modalidades cada vez más demandada. Curso de inglés trimestral por videoconferencia. No importa dónde te encuentres. Con las clases a través de videoconferencia, tendrás tu clase Vaughan con un ritmo de clase brutal. Nunca te vas a aburrir. Nunca vas a perder la concentración. Pruébalo, dinamismo e intensidad. Llama al 911-335833. 911-335833. Eso si estás en Madrid, porque en Barcelona puedes llamar al 93-339-8687. 93-339-8687.
Don Quijote y Sancho Panza, Cleopatra y Marco Antonio, Adán y Eva, Romeo y Julieta, Vaughan y Disney. ¿Eh?
Sí, ya lo has oído. Vaughan y Disney siguen colaborando para que tus hijos aprendan inglés mientras se divierten. La magia de Disney con la calidad de Vaughan. Entra en grupovaughan.com e infórmate.
Avon English Class is not the same as other English classes. In Avon English Class, time is optimized to the max. Every minute counts for your company. Every minute counts for your English. It's all a question of mathematics. The more you practice key structures of the language in every class, the more confident you will be when you use them in real life. And the more effective you will be as a communicator in English. And in this global world of ours, communicating effectively is absolutely key to success. By means of face-to-face classes or video conference classes, Vaughan will make all the difference for your English. And you will make all the difference for your company.
Más información en Barcelona en el 933398687. En Madrid en el 911335831.
You're listening to Vaughan Radio.
Esta es La Hora Extra, con Richard Vaughan.
Hello and welcome back. All right, we're back for our second half hour. And the question you asked me before was a question, well, it's a topic I have spoken about many, many times. You're probably tired of hearing it, but children... I've seen this many, many times, especially with music. Children or young adults who have incredibly good musical ears, perfect pitch, we say, perfect pitch, tono perfecto. It's when they were children, when they were babies, there was music in the house. There was music in the house. And they know. I mean, a child... If you put music around a child from the day it's born, and there's music, but it's classical music, rock music, jazz music, it doesn't matter. By the time the child is 5 years old, you can go to a piano and say, what note is this? Da, and he says, re minor, re bemol, or something, boom. And he knows it perfectly. They know it perfectly. They have perfect pitch because from the beginning their ear was absorbing music. And for language, it's the same. Children understand English or Spanish. Children understand their mother tongue before they turn one. I mean, as an infant, they understand it. When they're 6 months old, even younger, they understand. And their brain is absorbing. And if you give them two languages simultaneously, they have no problem. My children grew up hearing English and Spanish at home as if it were the most natural thing. They thought that all mothers spoke one way and all fathers spoke in a different way. When they were 2 years old, they didn't think of this in terms of English and Spanish as two different languages. They just thought that los papás hablaban con una tonalidad y las mamás con otra. You know. And so it's just different. It's like a father has a masculine voice and mothers have a feminine voice. Well, then they assimilate this as reality. And in my house, they assimilate it as reality that daddy speaks in a different way than mommy. But they understood us both, and no problem. By the time they were 4 years old, they began to understand that we were speaking different languages, and that many other fathers didn't speak English like me. They didn't speak like me, like their father. And now you have to take advantage of this incredible opportunity of absorption of skills in a natural way without any effort, an effortless absorption of valuable skills. musicality and a language. So I would recommend, if you are going to have a child, or if you're going to have a grandchild, that you insist with your children or your daughter or your son to keep at least 1 hour every day the sound, a spoken voice speaking. It could be a TED talk. It could be a 1 hour interview with David Cameron or Tony Blair. And you put it on within earshot of the baby. Se dice mucho within earshot. A disparo de oído, o sea, para que le llegue. Se dice within earshot of the infant. When the baby is 4 days old, and do it every day, and they will develop the ability to discriminate the sounds after 1 year. And when the child turns one, on the child's first birthday, that child will have assimilated 360 hours of English, at least, and do it the same thing in the second year. It's a quantitative question. So yes, your children, if you want them to speak English well when they enter the labor market at age 22 or 23, well, then you need to start at the age of 4 days. Well, you need to. Very recommendable. And so if they can absorb maybe 1,500 hours of English before the age of five, the sound of the language is just so familiar. It's a friend. And then when they need to start learning English seriously, they're in the perfect position. So, yes, more questions. Come on, ask me questions. Did gunpowder presage the end of castle building? Wow, that's an interesting question, and that's a very high-level English, my God. Yes. Did gunpowder presage the end of castle building? Well, the introduction of gunpowder from the East. Gunpowder, la pólvora. Gunpowder came from China, and it penetrated, it reached Europe, I think, in the 14th century. The 14th century, that's in the 1300s. And, yes, it presaged, interesting verb to presage. In Spanish, is it presagio? Yes, augured, augurio. Or something like that. Yes, it presaged the end of castle building. Castles, interesting. During the Roman times, they didn't build castles. They built fortresses made of wood. They were easier. You could build more quickly. And you could defend. But they built walls around the cities. That is true. Castles, no. As far as I know, the Romans didn't build castles. They built walls. Rome had two walls, the original early wall and a later wall. And so the different armies, when they besieged a city, they needed to have towers and to build siege equipment, maquinaria de para sitiar, para de asedio, maquinaria de asedio, torres de asedio. I don't know how to say it in Spanish. Besiege, yeah, siege equipment, siege towers, in order to approach the walls of the city and to breach the walls. Interesting verb, to breach. We use it in legal terminology, breach of contract. Breach, como reach, reach is alcanzar. Con B delante, tenemos breach. After breach. Breach of contract is incumplimiento de contrato, infra. It's a breach. And so we also have to breach is violar, infringir. Violar, no, no de violación, not sexual, no. Infringir. But to breach the walls would be atravesar las, o sea, superar y atravesar las murallas. To breach the walls of a city.
But castles didn't exist in Roman times. This was a phenomenon of the Middle Ages. Very quickly, after the fall of the Roman Empire and the establishment of a new type of modus vivendi in Europe, castles were built. Spain, of course, when the Muslims invaded Spain and successfully took most of the Iberian Peninsula in 7 years, by the years they entered in 711, and by 718, the Muslims controlled all of Spain except part of Cantabria and Asturias. And then, very very soon, the kingdom of Oviedo, the kingdom of Asturias, began to penetrate down in Galicia into the and to build castles in the area of northern Burgos, northern León. In these areas, they began to build castles. And every time there was a successful movement forward, they built castles. A line of castles along the Duero, a line of castles along the Tajo, a line of castles along the Guadiana, a line of castles, etc. There are a lot of castles in Spain. And but the country with the most castles, I believe, is Germany. Let's see. I think Germany. Let's see. Here it says, if castle gazing is what you're after, this is very colloquial English. Castle gazing, el mirar castillos es lo que. Si estás detrás de mirar castillos, así se dice in this form in English. If castle gazing is what you're after, what are you after? What are you after means, ¿qué estás persiguiendo? O sea, ¿detrás de qué estás? Pues estoy detrás de ver muchos castillos. Okay, so if castle gazing is what you're after, your first stop should be Germany. Okay. It has more castles than any other country. There are so many castles in Germany that the total number is not known. Some people think it could be over 25,000. That's a lot, eh? 25,000, come on. The European Castle Institute started recording German castles in 2018 in order to get an exact number. However, it expects to spend 10 years completing its count. I don't know about that. Sometimes when you see statistics, all right, let's see. First of all, let's look at this. Don't always believe everything you read, okay? Well, I imagine it's true. Okay. But I'm going to check anyway. Let's look at the square kilometers of Germany. All right. Let's see. Germany has, how big is Germany? Population, 83 million. Area, 357,000 square kilometers. All right. 357,000 square kilometers. Very good. Now, 357. Eso es lo que dije, ¿no? Yes, 357 divided by 505. That means Germany is 70% the size of Spain. Spain is more or less 1.3 times bigger than Germany. Okay, now, 357,000 square kilometers. Now, let's find out, or let's try to calculate. Let's see, 357,000 divided by how many castles did I say in Germany? How many castles? I've lost my place. I don't remember. Let's see. There are 25,000. All right. 25,000. So, divided by 25,000, that means there is a castle every 14 square kilometers. Every 14 square kilometers, there's a castle in Germany. Now, what is the square root of 14? What's the square root? Now, the square root of 14 is 3.8. 3.7. So 3.7 kilometers. And by 3.7 kilometers, boom, you have a castle. And then another right next door, the next place, another. And it gives me the impression that there are castles everywhere. And it also depends on your definition of castle. Of course, some castles are very big and impressive. Other castles could be like relatively moderate size manor houses. I really don't know. It depends on your definition of castle, counting castles. But nevertheless, there are a lot of castles. I've also read that the Czech Republic has more castles per capita. There are more than any. It has 2,000 castles. But I've also heard that Wales. So it's never, when you see statistics, take it with a grain of salt. Take it with a pinch of salt when you see statistics. For example, now with the coronavirus, every day we hear statistics or read statistics about people who have contracted the virus, hospitalizations, deaths, and you hear them in many different ways, per capita, in absolute terms and relative terms. And you can get a... And also, you have to understand that certain countries are very zealous in statistic keeping. The United States is very zealous in statistics. I don't know why, but the Americans love statistics. Zealous means celoso, muy con mucho celo. Recopilan y estadísticas y datos. And so, always. In other countries are bah. And so you don't know for sure. You don't know for sure. And the number of... And also, for example, in the United States, they are testing everybody. And so if you're going to test the entire population, you're going to find, discover more cases. But here in Spain, they haven't tested probably more than 5% of the population or 10% of the population. So testing, the more you test, the more cases are going to come to the surface. So statistics. Who was it? I think it was Winston Churchill, I'm not sure, said there are three types of lies. Tres tipos de mentira. A lie, a normal lie, a dirty lie, and statistics, or something like that. But I don't think it was Churchill. I can't remember. There are three kinds of lies. Aki, who was it who said that? Lies, damned lies, and statistics. All right. Who was it that said that? Benjamin Disraeli, the British Prime Minister. Benjamin Disraeli. It's an interesting man. He was Jewish. And he was perhaps the most important Prime Minister of the 19th century in England, in Great Britain. Although at the beginning of the century, during the Napoleonic period, no sé quién the younger, I'm trying to remember the names of, was very important, but he died very young. Oh, I can't remember the name. But I'll come back to that later. But Benjamin Disraeli was one of the most important politicians in Great Britain between maybe 1848, the revolution, the 1850 and 1880, Benjamin Disraeli. And he said, there are three types of lies. Lies, damned lies, and statistics. All right. All right. And it is true, you need to be careful with statistics. You know, I heard a statement maybe 20 years ago that 10% of the male population in Spain is homosexual. And I said, well, that's a lot. And I said, wait a minute. The male population in Spain is probably around 21 million? Okay, 10% is 2.1 million. 2 million. Seems like a lot. When you put it into real numbers, you put it in and don't always accept statistics at face value. Don't always. You know, I'm not sure if it was Benjamin Disraeli or Mark Twain who said this. Mark Twain. Let me try. Lies, damned lies, and statistics is a phrase describing the persuasive power of numbers, particularly the use of statistics to support weak arguments. Argumentaciones débiles. Let's see. The phrase derive is from the full sentence. There are three kinds of lies. Lies, damned lies, and statistics. It was popularized in the United States by Mark Twain, who mistakenly attributed it to British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli. So it wasn't Benjamin Disraeli. Mark Twain, the American author, mistakenly attributed this statement. The phrase is not found in any of Disraeli's works, and the earliest known appearance were years after his death. So we don't really know. But it is Mark Twain in chapters from my autobiography. He said, figures often beguile me. And it's interesting because if you're used to statistics, people tend to believe you. For many years in the 1980s and the 1990s, I gave a presentation about contact lenses for hens as a joke. And people were laughing. Lentes de contacto para gallinas. But I dressed the presentation with statistics about the hen population in Spain, the hen population in the United States, in France, in Australia, the productivity of egg production in Spain, and the number one country was Australia. And I was giving all these very, very specific statistics, and people began to believe everything I said. And in the end, they were dumbfounded. Said, ¿será posible? And so I was asking them to invest and in order to buy the patent for Spain for the import and commercialization of contact lenses for hens. And I gave them a breakdown of the egg production industry in Spain and the companies that were important in these things. So it's interesting. But it is true that if you go into Google and you write contact lenses for hens, and you'll see red contact lenses for chickens, contact lenses for laying hens. And so it's true. This is not this was based on a true story of inserting contact lenses in the eyes of hens. Why? In order to reduce their vision to basically 30% of normal vision. And this way, the hens were docile, and didn't establish a pecking order, a social order among hens by pecking each other, because it can be deadly. If you put hens together, 30% of them die because of the pecking order. They peck them until they kill them. But if they can't see very well, the hens apparently don't feel threatened or don't feel the need to establish a social order, which we call pecking order. Peck is picar. Cuando una gallina pica a la otra es to peck. And we say pecking order we use it figuratively for a social order established in a human organization. What's in Baugan? ¿Cuál es el pecking order? O sea, ¿quién manda y quién es segundo, quién es tercero? The pecking order. It's quite common in high schools, in secondary school, there's a pecking order is established on who's popular, who's not popular, and things like that. You see it on television or in the movies about American secondary schools, American high schools. They establish a pecking order. La chica de más, the boy and girl who are the most popular, the queen of the football game and things. It's a pecking order. So it is true, this question of contact lenses. But when I was presenting this in the 1980s, people didn't believe me. And I dressed it with statistics, not correct statistics, by the way. Well, some of them were correct. But I added other statistics that I made up. And people fell into the trap. They believed it. So be careful with statistics. Take statistics with a grain of salt. If they say 30% of the people in Spain still go to Sunday Mass, a la misa de los domingos, 30%, said, ah, sí, oh, 30%. But convert that into real people, and you will see that, all right, let's see, 10% is 4 million, 4.5 million. 20% is, well, 9 million. And so 30% is 13.5 million. 13.5 million people go to Mass every Sunday? Maybe. But at least you're checking it. You're not necessarily accepting everything at face value. I have to go. My time is up for today, for the next hour. Have a great evening. And tune in tomorrow morning for Richard Vaughan Live.